It was near dark when I reached the quarter. Though I didn't feel like going into the house, I thought I owed Miss Emma that respect. The door was shut against the cold, but somebody opened it immediately when I knocked. The room was crowded and warm from a nice fire in the fireplace. People spoke quietly, but still it was noisy. Miss Emma lay under a quilt, her head resting on two pillows. The mosquito bar hung on the bed behind her. I asked her how she felt. She did not answer. Only a slight movement at the corner of her mouth showed that she had heard me. Her eyes were looking at something that was not in the room. I left the bed and went into the kitchen, where most of the talking was going on. My aunt was in charge back there. As Miss Emma's best friend, she was taking over now that Miss Emma had taken to her bed. She was at the stove, making coffee. You could smell that Luzerne coffee all over the kitchen. At home, I made a fire in my aunt's room so it would be warm when she came home. And I went round to my side of the house and lit a fire there, too. I had just finished eating and was washing the plate in the pan of soap water when I heard someone come up the front porch. Vivian was at the door. We stood there looking at each other a moment. Then she came in and took off her coat and galoshes. We went to sit at the fire in my room. "I'm glad you came." I asked Vivian to lie on the bed beside me. We lay on our sides for a while, then we lay on our backs looking up at the ceiling. The room's only light came from the fireplace. "Is that her house up where the cars are?" Vivian asked. "Yes." I wanted to stop in, but I didn't know if I should.
"You can go by before you leave."
"You think I ought to?"
"I want you to," I said.
"I don't want to cause any trouble."
"You won't."
"I want them to like me," she said.
"They will.
They'll have to." "I don't want it that way."
"I'm going to live my own life, Vivian, and I hope you're part of it. If they like it, it's all right. If they don't, it's the same."
Vivian was quiet. We were holding hands, lying very close together with all our clothes on.
"Let me explain it to you. Let me see if I can explain it to you," I said.
"We black men have failed to protect our women since the time of slavery. We stay here in the South and are broken, or we run away and leave them alone to look after the children and themselves. So each time a male child is born, they hope he will be the one to change this vicious circle, which he never does. Because even though he wants to change it, and maybe even tries to change it, it is too heavy a burden because of all the others who have run away and left their burdens behind. So he, too, must run away if he is to hold on to his sanity and have a life of his own."
"I can see by your face you don't agree, so I'll try again. What she wants is for him, Jefferson, and me to change everything that has been going on for 300 years. She wants it to happen so in case she ever gets out of bed again, she can go to that little church there in the quarter and say proudly, 'You see, I told you. I told you he was a man.' And if she dies an hour after that, all right. But what she wants to hear first is that he did not crawl to that white man, that he stood at that last moment and walked. Because if he does not, she knows that she will never get another chance to see a black man stand for her.
And for the others there in the quarter, it's the same. They look at their fathers, their grandfathers, their uncles, their brothers, all broken. They see me. And I, who grew up on that same plantation, can teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. I can give them something that neither a husband, a father, nor a grandfather ever did, so they want to hold on as long as they can, not realizing that their holding on will break me too. That in order for me to be what they think I am, what they want me to be, I must run as the others have done in the past. Now do you see? Do you see?"
"Will that circle ever be broken?" she asked.
"It's up to Jefferson, my love." Paul opened the steel door. For the first time, the prisoners did not call to me or stick their hands through the bars as I passed. Some spoke quietly, others only nodded, but all were watching. Paul and I continued down the block to the last cell. Jefferson was lying on his back, staring up at the ceiling.
What day is it?
It's Friday, Jefferson.
Friday?
He was quiet for a moment. Then he slowly let his feet slide to the floor as he sat up on the bunk.
Look like it's pretty out there.
He was gazing up at the window. Yes, it's a nice day. No clouds anywhere, just blue.
You think it's gonna be like that day?
I hope it's the kind of day you want, Jefferson.
The kind of day I want? The kind of day I want. I never got nothing I wanted in my whole life. Now I'm gonna get a whole day?
I didn't know what to say. He looked at me for a while, then he turned to the window again. Do you like fruit, Jefferson? I can pick up some fruit and some pecans. Ice cream, funny books, things like that.
I want me a whole gallon of ice cream.
I saw a slight smile come on his face, and it was not a bitter smile. Not bitter at all.
A whole gallon of vanilla ice cream. Ain't never had enough ice cream. Never had more than a nickel cone. Used to run out in the quarter and hand the ice cream man my nickel and he gave me a little scoop on the cone. But now I'm gonna get me a whole gallon. That's what I want. A whole gallon. Eat it with a pot stove.
I can bring you some ice cream anytime, Jefferson.
I'm gonna wait. I want a whole gallon. Eat it with a pot spoon. Every bit of it with a pot spoon.
He smiled. He smiled now because he had something pleasant to look forward to, though it would be on that last day. And he would save it until that very last moment. You want to hear about the news from the quarter? Stella had her baby. He looked at me, not as he had done in the past, in pain, with hate. He looked at me with an inner calmness now. Was it the ice cream?
He favored Gable.
With little babies, they don't favor anybody too much.
Oh, Gable. Got himself a baby.
Inez still giving her fares up the quarter, I said. But no music. No dancing. She calls that sinning. If you want your music at a fair, you got to go down to Willie Aaron's house. Willie still has that stack of old low-down blues. Tampa Red, Mercy D, you know all of them. I just thought of something. Let me bring you a little radio. You can have music all the time. You can listen to Randy's record shop late at night.
Randy's still on?
Yes, he's still on. I was listening to him just the other night. I have to play the radio low so that Tanner Lou can't hear it. These old people, you know, all music except church music is sinning music. So I play it so low I can hardly hear myself. I laugh. To make him laugh, but he did not. Do you want me to bring you a little radio next time I come? He nodded. Edwin has these little Philcos, not too big. I boxed my hand to show him the approximate size of the radio. Get it tomorrow, I said. I'll have them bring it to you, so you'll have music over the weekend. He didn't have any more to say. He sat there, not looking out the window, but now looking down at the floor as if he'd forgotten about the radio, about the ice cream, about everything. Miss Emma felt well enough on Monday to accompany my aunt and Reverend Ambrose to visit Jefferson. After the usual search, Paul led them to the day room, then went to the cell for Jefferson. Jefferson asked if he could take the radio. The deputy said no. Jefferson said he wouldn't go. I would hear later that Jefferson had not turned off the radio since Paul brought it to him on Friday evening.
Radio?
Miss Emma asked Paul. Grant brought him one.
When?
Last Friday.
That mean he ain't coming?
That's what he said, the deputy told her. Miss Emma sat, staring at the space where Jefferson was supposed to sit. Then she looked up at Paul again.
Can we go to him?
Sure, but it's going to be uncomfortable y'all trying to eat out them pans standing up.
We don't mind,
Miss Emma said and pushed herself up from the table. My aunt helped her collect everything, then the three of them followed the deputy back to the cell. Jefferson lay on his bunk, listening to the music from the radio. 45 minutes later, when Paul returned to the cell, he found the radio turned off and Jefferson lying on his side, facing the wall, his back to the people. The deputy opened the door and let them out, and Jefferson turned from the wall and snapped on the radio. Reverend Ambrose came back to the quarter between 2:30 and 3 o'clock, and when I dismissed school, one of the boys came back to tell me that my aunt wanted to see me at Miss Emma's house before I went home. All three of them were sitting around the kitchen table when I came in.
Why?
Why what, Tannaloo?
That radio,
she said.
That radio.
What's wrong with the radio?
What's wrong with it? Reverend Ambrose cut in. What's wrong with it? That's all he do is listen to that radio. That's what's wrong with it.
And what's wrong with that?
I asked. He didn't have time to come sit down with us today. That's what's wrong with that, the minister said. He ain't got time for nothing else. That's what's wrong with that.
Jefferson needs something in that cell.
Yes, he do, the minister said. But not that box.
And what do you suggest, Reverend Ambrose?
God. He ain't got but 5 more Fridays and a half. He needs God in that cell. Not a sin box.
What sin box?
What you call that kind of music he listened to? Us standing in there trying to talk to him, and him listening to that thing till she got to reach over and turn it off. What you call it?
I call it company, Reverend Ambrose.
And I call it sin company, he said.
And I don't care what you call it.
Grant, you don't talk like that.
My aunt stopped a step or two away from me, though it was clear she wanted to slap me.
We have to get something straight around here, I said, and right now. I don't know a thing about God or sin. What I know is, my Lord, the minister said, looking at me as if I were the devil himself. Listen to the teacher of all children. Last Friday, I continued, was the first time, the very first time that Jefferson looked at me without hate, without accusing me of putting him in that cell. Last Friday was the first time he ever asked me a question or answered me without accusing me for his condition. I don't know if you all know what I'm talking about. It seems you don't, but I found a way to reach him for the first time. Now he needs that radio and he wants it. He wants something of his own before he dies. He wants a gallon of ice cream for his last supper. Did he tell you that? Did he tell you that he never had enough ice cream? Did he tell you that he never had a radio of his own before? Did he tell you any of this? He wants those things before he dies. He only has a month to live, and all I'm trying to do is make it as comfortable as I can for him.
Turning him against God?
My aunt asked. Tannaloo, that radio has nothing to do with turning Jefferson against God. That radio is there to help him not think about death. He's locked up in that cage like an animal. And what else can he think about but that last day and that last hour? That radio makes it less painful. Now, if you all want that radio out of there, you just go on and take it from him. But I won't go back up there anymore.
We got to have it your way or else that's it, Reverend Ambrose cut in.
No, I said, you can have it your way. You can take it from him, but you won't reach him if you do. The only thing that keeps him from thinking that he is not a hog is that radio. Take that radio away, and let's see what you can do for the soul of a hog.
And that whole gallon of ice cream, the minister said. You sure you reached him?
I didn't know how to answer that.
Well, Mr. Teacher, I'm waiting for your answer.
My aunt and Miss Emma were also waiting.
I went back to see Jefferson again on Wednesday. You did not hear the music until you got near the cell. The radio was playing Western music on a station out of Baton Rouge, so we just sat there quietly a while. Jefferson, I finally said, I want to be your friend. I want you to ask me questions. I want you to say anything that comes to your mind, anything you want to say to me. I don't care what it is, say it. I'll keep it to myself if you want. I'll talk about it to other people if you want. Will you do that for me? He nodded his head. He was staring at the wall. I just thought of something. Sometimes at night, sometimes when you're thinking about something and may not be able to remember when I come back, I was just thinking maybe I could bring you a little notebook and a pencil. You could write your thoughts down and we could talk about it when I came back. Or maybe you could talk to Reverend Ambrose about it when he came to visit you. Would you like that?
All right.
You want me to bring it?
If you want.
And you would write down your thoughts? Anything you want to talk about? But he was not listening. I looked around the cell at the seatless brown stained commode, the wash bowl whose faucet never stopped dripping, the little metal shelf over the bowl which held his pan, tin cup, and spoon. Through the barred window, I could see the branches of the sycamore tree stirring from a soft breeze. There was still a chill in the air. Miss Emma thought we should all visit Jefferson together as often as we could. I wasn't crazy about the idea of being at the courthouse at the same time as the minister, but one look from my aunt, and I decided that I would go along. At least once. The first thing you heard were the chains around his ankles. Then Jefferson entered the room through the rear door, followed by the deputy.
I brought you some good old gumbo,
Miss Emma said to Jefferson. How's it going, partner? I said as I took my seat beside him. Miss Emma put rice in each pan, and then she poured gumbo over the rice until the pan was nearly full. Besides shrimps, she had put smoked sausage and chicken in the gumbo, and she had seasoned it well with green onions, filet, and black pepper. Gumbo was something you could always eat, even if you were not hungry. I started in. May we bow our heads, the minister said after I had put down my spoon. Jefferson's head had been bowed from the moment he sat down. I lowered my eyes. Our Father, who art in heaven, Reverend Ambrose began. He went through the Lord's Prayer, but that was only for warming up. Then he really got down to praying. He asked God to come down to Bayonne, in the courthouse, into the jail, walk along the cell block, go into each cell, touch each heart, come into this room and touch the hearts of those who did not know him in pardon of their sins. As he prayed, the minister would slump closer and closer to the table. Then he would jerk his head up and gaze at the ceiling. But all I was thinking about was the gumbo was getting cold. Finally, Reverend Ambrose brought his prayer sermon to an end. The gumbo was warm, but not hot.
Ain't you gonna eat, Jefferson?
Miss Emma said.
I ain't hungry.
You want to walk? I said to Jefferson. He moved on the bench without answering. You could hear the chains around his ankles as he swung his legs over the bench. Then he braced his cuffed hands against the table to push himself up. We started walking around the room. Miss Emma watched us. My aunt and the minister went on eating, but they did not seem to be enjoying their food. Jefferson, I said, we had started walking. Do you know what a hero is? A hero is someone who does something for other people. He does something that other men don't and can't do. I lowered my voice until we had passed the table.
I could never be a hero. I teach, but I don't like teaching. I teach because it is the only thing an educated black man can do in the South today. I don't like it. I hate it. I don't even like living here. I want to run away. I want to live for myself and for my woman and nobody else. That is not a hero. A hero does for others. He would do anything for people he loves because he knows it would make their lives better. I am not that kind of person, but I want you to be. You could give something to her, to me, to those children in the quarter. You could give them something that I never could. They expect it from me, but not from you. The white people out there are saying that you don't have it, that you're a hog, not a man, but I know they're wrong. You have the potentials we all have, no matter who we are. Those out there are no better than we are, Jefferson. I have always done what they wanted me to do. Teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. Nothing else. Nothing about dignity. Nothing about identity. Nothing about loving and caring. They never thought we were capable of learning those things. Teach those niggas how to print their names and how to figure on their fingers. And I went along, but hating myself all the time for doing so. We were coming up on the table again, and the ones at the table were quiet and trying to hear what we were saying. I did not start talking again until we had passed them. Do you know what a myth is, Jefferson? I asked him. A myth is an old lie that people believe in. White people believe that they're better than anyone else on earth, and that's a myth. The last thing they ever want to see is a black man stand and think and show that common humanity that's in us all. It would destroy their myth. They would no longer have justification for having made us slaves and keeping us in the condition we are in. As long as none of us stand, they are safe. They're safe with me. They're safe with Reverend Ambrose. I don't want them to feel safe with you anymore. I want you to chip away at that myth by standing. I want you, yes, you, to call them liars. I want you to show them that you are as much a man, more a man than they can ever be. That jury, you call them men? That judge, is he a man? The governor is no better. They play by the rules their forefathers created hundreds of years ago. Their forefathers said that we're only 3/5 human, and they believe it to this day. Sheriff Guidry does, too. He calls me Professor, but he doesn't mean it. He calls Reverend Ambrose Reverend, but he doesn't respect him. When I showed him the notebook and pencil that I brought you, he grinned. Do you know why? He believes it was just a waste of time and money. What can a hog do with pencil and paper? We stopped. His head was down. Look at me, Jefferson, please, I said. He raised his head. He had been crying. He raised his cuffed hands and wiped one eye, then the other. I need you, I told him. I'm no hero. I can just give something small. That's all I have to offer. It is the only way we can chip away at that myth. You. You can be bigger than anyone you have ever met. Please listen to me, because I would not lie to you now. I speak from my heart. You have a chance of being bigger than anyone who has ever lived on that plantation or come from this little town. You have seen how Mr. Farrell makes a slingshot handle. He starts with just a little piece of rough wood, any little piece of scrap wood. Then he starts cutting, cutting and cutting and cutting, then shaving. Shaves it down clean and smooth till it's not what it was before, but something new and pretty. You know what I'm talking about, because you had one that he made from a piece of scrap wood. Yes, yes, I saw you with it. And it came from a piece of wood that he found in the yard somewhere. And that's all we are, Jefferson, all of us on this earth. A little piece of drifting wood until we, each of us individually, decide to become something else. I am still that piece of drifting wood, and those out there are no better. But you can be better.
because we need you to be and want you to be. Me, your godmother, the children, and all the rest of them in the quarter. Do you understand what I'm saying to you, Jefferson? Do you? He looked at me in great pain. He may not have understood, but something was touched, something deep down in him, because he was still crying. I cry, not from reaching any conclusion by reasoning, but because lowly as I am still part of the whole. Is that what he was thinking as he looked at me crying? Come on, I said, let's have some gumbo. And we went back to the table. Reverend Ambrose, my aunt, and Miss Emma returned to the quarter, and I went back uptown to the Rainbow Club. The place was in semi-darkness as usual, with three old men at the bar doing more talking than drinking, and only two other people in the place. A couple of mulatto bricklayers sitting at a table. I had come here to tell Vivian that everything had gone well. Jefferson and I were communicating, and he and his nan-nan were also talking. I was feeling very good, and I wanted to tell her before I told anyone else. I did not wish to tell her about the envy I had seen in the minister's face. No, I would not say that. I had ordered a bourbon and water from Claiborne, and I was sipping it slowly and thinking about Vivian and about Jefferson. Things had not been going too well for Vivian and me in bed, and I knew it was because of Jefferson, my worrying about him. Between him and school, I was drained of my energy. Vivian knew that too, and she was ready to accept it, much more than I was. She knew how it had been before, and she knew how it would be again, and she told me not to worry about it, but that was not enough for me. I did worry. I didn't think anything in the world was worth us not being able to make it well in bed. Nothing. And that was one of the reasons I had come back here to see her. To tell her that I finally had reached him and that I would be more relaxed now and that it was going to be all right between her and me from now on. The two brick-colored bricklayers were still talking over in the corner. I heard the word nigger a few times, and I heard the words should have been done long ago, but I never made the connection. There was a tall one and there was a short, fat one. The tall one was doing most of the talking, and I could tell he was angry. Maybe it was over his job. I had seen both of them before, without being friendly, and I knew that, like so many of the mulattoes in this part of the state, they did bricklaying or carpentry and possibly some house painting. All this by contract, and all this to keep from working in the field side by side with the niggers. Since emancipation, almost 100 years ago, they would do any kind of work they could find to keep from working side by side in the field with the niggers. They controlled most of the bricklaying business in this part of the state. Even took that kind of work from the white boys because they would do it so much cheaper than the white boys would. Anything not to work alongside the niggers. With school, it was the same. Many of them would drop out of school, would get a trade, bricklayer or carpenter, rather than sit in a class side by side with the niggers. Dumb as hell, but prejudiced as hell. Should have burned them months ago, one said. I figured it was the tall one because out of the corner of my eye, I had seen that he was doing most of the talking. That kind of son of a bitch make it hard on everybody, he went on. I'd pull the switch myself, they asked me. I knew now what they were talking about and who they were talking about, but I told myself to keep it cool. Let them talk. They were probably out of work and it was just plain frustration that made them go on like that. Just cool it, I told myself. You just cool it now. The old forester was not doing anything to keep me from listening. It was helping me listen. Let them talk, I said again to myself. If you can't stand here and take it, then get into your car and leave. You came in here in a good mood because this was one of the best days you have had with him, and you can't let this kind of trash destroy that good feeling. So don't. All right? I finished the drink and sucked on an ice cube as I rolled the glass around in the palm of my hands. I raised the glass for the last drop before setting it on the bar. I turned around slowly and looked at them.
The tall one with the cowboy hat and the short fat one with a baseball cap turned backwards on his head. All I was going to do was lean back against the bar for a moment. Then I was going to walk out. Then the tall one said something, and the fat one snickered. And I thought I had heard enough. I went up to their table. Shut up.
What?
The tall one said. You heard me. I said, shut up. He grinned at me.
You don't mean that.
You shut up or get up, I said. I mean that.
He looked at his buddy, then back at me, and the hatred in those light brown eyes was thick enough to cut with a cane knife. He grinned.
Fine with me, partner.
He braced himself against the table to stand up, but he was getting up with too much confidence, and I hit him before he had a chance to protect himself, and down he went over the back of that chair. Just as I expected, old fat boy jumped up too, and I caught him in the face with the side of my fist, and I saw him fall back and throw his hand up to his mouth. I got my back to the wall so I could keep both of them in front of me. I don't know whether Claiborne came over the bar, under the bar, or around the bar, but he was there now. And he had grabbed the fat one, and he was hollering for me and the other one to cut it out.
Not in here, he was hollering. Not in here, goddammit!
The tall one was up, and he was trying to move in on me, and I knew if nobody stopped this thing, I was in for a fight. He was taller and heavier and stronger than I, and he had 3 or 4 generations of bricklaying genes in him, while I had only cane cutting in mine. Out of the corner of my eye, I could still see Claiborne wrestling with the fat one, while continuing to holler at me and the tall one to stop. But since the tall one was not paying any attention to him, I wasn't about to drop my guard. He swung at me again, and this time he landed, not his fist, his arm. And I thought it was chicken shit of him to hit me with an arm and not a fist, as a man should hit a man, but I was thinking from the floor. I kicked him in the shin. He fell back. I got to my feet. He was right on me again, and he swung. I went under it and intentionally caught him below the belt. He buckled over, grabbing at his nuts with both hands, and he started swinging with the one arm to ward me off. I hit him twice, hard. He was still on his feet. He was insane now, like a wounded animal in pain, and nothing could stop him. He hit me solidly on the arm, and down I went. I had never felt so much pain before, and I knew that there was no way I was going to get up, that I was going to die there. I was on my knees, and I was sure that the next feeling, my last, would be a shoe under my chin or in my side. I was waiting for it to happen the way a condemned man must wait for the last hundredth of a second for the guillotine to fall. But it never did, because Thelma, with her broom, got between us. He was too much of a gentleman to knock her out of the way. It gave me time to get to my feet. Boxing is over, I said, and I grabbed a chair, and I threw it at him. After that, it was dark. Completely dark.
What happened?
Claiborne knocked you out,
Vivian responded.
Why did Claiborne knock me out?
You wouldn't stop fighting.
Did he knock him out, too?
No.
Well, why didn't he knock him out?
He quit. Claiborne told him he would shoot his head off if he didn't, and he quit. You wouldn't.
I didn't hear Claiborne say anything like that to me.
That's what he told me. Said he knocked Griffin out first. You were the next one closest to him. He hollered at you to stop, kept hollering at you, and you went on swinging that chair, so he just came up behind you and knocked you out.
With that gun?
That's all he had in his hand when I got there. Poor Mr. Gusta, running up and down the street, calling my name. Come stop you. Come stop you.
I'm sorry, honey.
No, you're not sorry.
I just couldn't help it.
Yes, yes, you could.
I couldn't.
You could have walked out of there.
Can Jefferson walk out of where he is?
We were sitting on her bed. There were matching lamps with matching shades on either side of the bed. The shades were pink with little white tassels. A chiffon robe was in the room, and there was a soft chair and dresser. I could see us, me and her, in the mirror above the dresser. I had a wet towel on my head, and my left hand was holding the towel in place. I didn't look too good, and I felt even worse. Vivian sighed.
Well, I guess that's that, she said.
That's what, honey?
You'll have to stay here for tonight.
What for?
Because you're in no condition to go home.
I'm all right, I said. I'll be all right in a minute. Honey, I don't want you in any trouble.
Well, I guess you should have thought about that at the Rainbow Club, she said.
They were talking about Jefferson, honey. What would you have done?
I would have walked out of there.
No, you would not. You would have said something.
Maybe that's what you should have done instead of swinging that chair.
It went well today, honey. It went very well. He and I walked around the room while I talked to him. Then we ate. His Nan-Nan was so proud. I brought in the pencil and notepad I told you about. It went good today, honey. Aren't you proud?
She brought two plates to the table and sat down. I sat down opposite her.
Still mad, huh?
I ate and looked at her.
Honey, suppose someone said something about you. Would you want me just to walk away? I love you, honey, and I need you, but I'm only human.
One day I'll bring flowers to the graveyard.
That's not you talking, honey.
No, she said, looking up at me. She had been holding it in a long time, and now she was going to let it out. I saw it coming as soon as I spoke. What is me? Tell me. What is me?
Honey.
No. Tell me, she said. Who am I? Who are you? Who are we? Tell me.
All I know is I love you.
That's not enough, she said. What is love?
Honey,
what is it? She asked. That bed? That's love?
Honey, please.
Give me some answers. Give me some answers. Today. Today I want answers.
Honey, I love you.
That's no answer. I don't know what you mean by love. That bed? The cane feel? What is love? Tell me what love is.
I didn't know what to say.
Nothing I would say was going to change anything.
I've done my best, I said.
No, you have not. In bed for a few moments is not enough.
Is that all I've ever given you? Is that all?
What else? Any consideration?
I got up from the table. I jerked the towel from my head and slammed it down on my plate.
You can have your goddamn red beans and rice and towel and everything else. Damn this shit. I went to the front door and jerked it open. And there was the screen. And through the screen I could see outside into the darkness. And I did not want to go out there. There was nothing outside this house that I cared for. Not school, not home, not my aunt, not the quarter, not anything in the world. I don't know how long I stood there looking out into the darkness. A couple of minutes, I suppose. Then I went back into the kitchen. I knelt down and buried my face in her lap. I lay across the bed in my room, looking out the window at the stack of bean poles in the garden. As far back as I could remember, my aunt would pull up rows of poles at the end of each season and stack them in that same corner of the garden until a new crop of beans was ready to be poled. Beyond the poles, on the other side of the road, I could see the tops of the pecan trees in Farrell Giroux's backyard. I had work to do, but as usual, I ended up doing only a little because of the singing and the praying up at the church. After Tana Lou and her company had been at the house a while, she came into my room.
You sleep?
I'm awake.
Reverend Ambrose liked to talk to you.
What about? I lay on my back gazing up at the ceiling, my hands clasped behind my head so that my arms stuck out forming a cross.
I done told you that's bad luck.
Without shifting my eyes from the ceiling, I unclasped my hands from behind my head and clasped them on my chest. Tantaloo stood there looking at me.
He can come in?
Sure he can come in.
You gonna put on your shoes and tuck in that shirt?
She asked. I'll put on my shoes and tuck in my shirt. She stood there watching me a while. Then she left the room. I sat up on the bed and passed my hands over my face. When the minister came into the room, I had tucked in my shirt and put on my shoes, and I was standing at the window looking out at the garden.
Care to sit down, Reverend?
He looked at my desk.
I see you've been working. I tried to, afraid I didn't get too much done. He sat down in the chair and looked up at me.
They learning anything?
I do my best, Reverend. He nodded his bald head.
I do the same. My best.
I waited to hear what he wanted to talk to me about.
There ain't much time.
Jefferson?
Yes.
3 weeks. He nodded his head. A small, tired little man. He had preached a long sermon today and it showed in his face.
He ain't saved.
I can't help you there, Reverend.
That's where you're wrong. He listened to you.
I looked out at the newly turned rows of earth and I wished I could just lie down between the rows and not hear and not be part of any of this.
This is a mean world, but there is a better one. I wish to prepare him for that better world, but I need your help.
I don't believe in that other world, Reverend.
Don't believe in God?
I believe in God, Reverend, I said, looking beyond the rows of turned up earth toward the budding pecan trees across the road.
I believe in God. Every day of my life, I believe in God. Just not that other world.
She told me to help him walk to that chair like a man, not a hog. And I'm doing the best I can, Reverend. The rest is up to you. He got up from the chair and came toward me. He peered at me intently, his face showing pain and confusion. He stopped at arm's distance from me, and I could smell in his clothes the sweat from his preaching.
You think you educated?
I went to college.
But what did you learn?
To teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, Reverend.
What did you learn about your own people?
What did you learn about her, round there? He said, gesturing toward the other room and trying to keep his voice down.
I'm the one that's educated. I know people like you look down on people like me, but I'm the one that's educated.
He stared at me as if he could not make up his mind whether to hit me or scream.
Grief, oh, grief. When will you cease? Oh, when?
He drew a deep breath. Then he began to speak faster.
When they had nothing else but grief, where was the release? None. None till he rose. And he said, there's relief from grief.
Do you know what I'm trying to say to you, boy?
I hear you talking, Reverend.
I won't let you send that boy's soul to hell, he said. I'll fight you with all the strength I have left in this body, and I'll win.
You don't have to fight me, Reverend. You can have him all to yourself.
I don't even have to go back up there if that's all you want.
You're going back,
he said, nodding his bald head and still trying hard to control his voice.
You owe her as much as I owe her. And as long as I can stand on my feet, I owe her and all the others every ounce of my being. And you do, too.
I don't owe anybody anything, Reverend, I said, and turned toward the window.
I felt his hand gripping my shoulder and pulling me around to face him.
Don't you turn your back on me, boy.
My name is Grant.
When you act educated, I'll call you Grant. I'll even call you Mr. Grant when you act like a man.
His hand still grasped my shoulder, and I needed all my willpower to keep from knocking it off. He could see what I was thinking, and he slowly released his grip and brought his hand to his side.
You think you're the only one ever felt this way? He asked. You think I never felt this way? You think she never felt this way? Every last one of them back there, one time in their life, wanted to give up. She want to give up now. You know that? You got any idea how sick she is? Soon after he go, she going too. I won't give her another year. I want her to believe he'll be up there waiting for her, and you can help me do it. And you the only one.
How?
Tell him to fall down on his knees before he walk to that chair. Tell him fall down on his knees for her. You the only one he'd listen to. He won't listen to me.
No, I said. I won't tell him to kneel.
I'll tell him to listen to you, but I won't tell him to kneel. I will try to help him stand. You think a man can't kneel and stand?
It hasn't helped me. The minister drew back from me. His head was shining. So was his face.
I could see his mouth working as though he wanted to say something but didn't know how to say it.
And suppose he asks you if you believe in heaven, then what?
I hope he doesn't, Reverend.
Suppose he do.
I hope he doesn't.
You couldn't say yes.
No, Reverend.
I couldn't say yes. I couldn't lie to him at this moment. I will never tell him another lie, no matter what.
Not for her sake.
No, sir.
The minister nodded his bald head and grunted to himself. His dark brown eyes and that tired, weary face continued to stare back at me.
You think you educated, but you not. You think you the only person ever had to lie? You think I never had to lie?
I don't know, Reverend.
Yes, you know. You know all right. That's why you look down on me, because you know I lie. At wakes, at funerals, at weddings, yes, I lie. I lie at wakes and funerals to relieve the pain, cause reading and writing and arithmetic is not enough. You think that's all they sent you to school for? They sent you to school to relieve pain, to relieve hurt, and if you have to lie to do it, then you lie. You lie, and you lie, and you lie. When you tell yourself you're feeling good when you're sick, you lying. When you tell other people you're feeling well when you're sick, you lying. You tell them that because they have pain too, and you don't want to add yours, and you lie. She's been lying every day of her life, your aunt in there. That's how you got through that university, cheating herself here, cheating herself there, but always telling you she's all right. I've seen her hands bleed from picking cotton. I've seen the blisters from the hole in the cane knife at that church, crying on her knees. You ever look at the scabs on her knees, boy? Course you never, cause she never wanted you to see it. And that's the difference between you and me, boy. That make me the educated one, and you the gump. I know my people. I know what they gone through. I know they done cheated themselves, lied to themselves, hoping that the one they all love and trust can come back and relieve the pain.